This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A 13-year-old murder victim, senior investigators at Scotland Yard, the families of terror bomb victims and soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, former Prime Minister Gordon Brown. The hacking scandal that closed the doors of the British tabloid News of the World deepens, enveloping even more News International papers owned by Rupert Murdoch, who, of course, has extensive media holdings in this country and Australia as well. An investigation turned up as many as 5,000 landline numbers and 4,000 mobile phones that may have been hacked. So, as Gordon Brown asked the BBC, if the Prime Minister can get hacked, what about ordinary citizens? Later this hour, presidential letters of condolence and suicide in the military. But first, has your voicemail or cell phone been hacked? And if you're an investigator, have you ever hacked somebody's phone? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org, click on Talk of the Nation. In a few minutes, Roger Cohen's defense of Rupert Murdoch. But we begin with mobile security expert John Herring. He joins us from our bureau in New York. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're all using this term phone hacking as if we know what it is and how to do it. What does it mean? What actually happened here?
Well, I think what we're seeing is that people are starting to realize that it's easier to hack than it ever has been before with respect to mobile devices. And data on mobile devices is essentially becoming digital currency. Now, in this case, voicemail was the key target. And what we've seen when voicemail systems are targeted is it's usually an attack on the network versus the device itself. And what we're seeing is essentially spoofing of the identity of a user to trick the system into thinking it is the actual owner of the voicemail account, mm-hmm. which allows the attacker to then bring the voicemail data itself into their possession.
So to start with that, you're going to need the phone number.
That's correct.
And where do you get that?
So it would depend. I mean, as you might imagine, phone numbers can be accessed in a number of different ways through internet queries or searches or through targeted espionage, if you will.
So some people even put their cell phone number on Facebook.
Yes, indeed.
There's no phone book in the old days. Young people might not. There was a white pages that had everybody's landline number in it, but there's no phone book for mobile phones.
That's right. And so it could come from a host of different places. I think what's important is for people to not take for granted that their data may not be secure and take some basic steps to actually secure them. Because what we've seen, these attacks are a lot less sophisticated than you might imagine.
Well, back in 19, the phone of the young girl, the murder victim who was hacked, that was some time ago. And that was probably not, her voicemail was probably not password protected in those days. But these days, just about everybody's phone mail voice box, you have to know the password to get into it, right?
Well, you would hope so. And what we're seeing, a vulnerability like this was discovered quite some time ago. And we've seen more of mobile operators defaulting to requiring a password, although there's scores of them around the world who still do not, where you have to actually set a password to protect your account. And that's why it's really important that everyone makes sure that they have a password set against their account. The marginal difference in terms of difficulty of the hack of having a password versus not is substantial.
So if you have a password, then you should probably make sure it's not the last four numbers of your telephone number.
Correct. Or 0000. Those
or
are two
of the worst
choices.
Yes. Yeah. The ones everybody can remember.
Correct.
And once they're into your voicemail, you can do anything in there.
That's right. And there's the opportunity to actually traverse around and potentially even gain other information beyond the voicemail or about the account itself.
There are other ways to hack your voicemail. If you can hack somebody's email, you can send out a query. Almost every system says you can recover your password and all that sort of stuff if you've forgotten it by getting in touch by email.
So maybe you're referring to someone who might use Google Voice or an internet-based voicemail service.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. Although what I would say is that in the context of security, email and the email account is really the lowest common denominator. As you might imagine, people's banking credentials, there's a whole host of things are authenticated via your email account. So I think if your email account gets compromised,
your voicemail might be
perhaps the
least of your problems.
Exactly,
I can
right.
understand that. So it's relatively easy then to hack into these voicemail systems for people who are used to doing it, who can social engineering is a phrase you read in connection with this. It's basically running a con game to get somebody's phone number or maybe even their password.
That's correct. I mean, you know, we see attacks against mobile devices and mobile infrastructure ranging from highly sophisticated technical attacks to attacks that are far more simple than you might imagine. And, you know, given 15 to 20 minutes and the right tools, pretty much anyone could be taught to do it. So it's important that we recognize that, yes, the sophisticated attacks need to be protected against, but it's really the low-hanging fruit that I think is the greatest cause of concern.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Has your phone been hacked? If so, why do you think? And if you're an investigator, well, have you done it? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we'll start with Jim. And Jim's with us from Sumter in South Carolina.
Hi, good day.
Hi.
Real quickly, off subject, I have an Android phone. It was hacked. I just formatted it. But that being said, the U.S. government commonly hacks everybody that's on a phone, mobile device, VoIP, whatever. On the U.S. patent site right now is a patent by Microsoft to record all Skype, VoIP, video game conversations. In the patent, it says old, outdated POTS, which is plain old telephone systems, are, you know, they're no longer being used, and it's tough for us to listen to what everybody's doing. So we would like to be able to hack everybody at the same time legally. So there's a patent, you know, up on the site right now that describes in detail how the government records every single conversation.
Well,
that happens.
I understand what you're saying, but first of all, why was your phone hacked, and how did you know it was?
Well, I mean, I'm an IT guy, and, you know, I rooted my phone just for fun, you know, to join the crowd, see what's out there. And as far as penetration testing, if you want to test your Wi-Fi to ensure that it's secure, you need to actually have the tools that people have, like FaceSniff and FireSheep and all these ugly little things you find out about on Twitter.
John Herring, I assume you know what he's talking about.
I do indeed. There are essentially hacking tools that allow anyone with one click or one tap to hack someone's credentials via a Wi-Fi network.
And is the guest correct that the government is able to hack every single phone call?
Well, many of the communications are encrypted. I think that it's possible for anyone to potentially intercept data, and I think that this only underscores the importance of encryption of the data itself, which I think he's pointing out.
All right. Jim, thanks very much for the phone call. And let's go next to, this is Race, and Race is with us from Tucson.
Yes, hello.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I was watching the Tour de France. I was streaming it via the Internet. It was an English-speaking channel from Europe, and I noticed there was an advertisement for a service for your phone where you could listen to other people's phone messages. So I was just wondering if folks were aware of the possibility there's actually a phone app or a service being marketed in Europe that does specifically this type of activity with your phone.
John Herring?
So it's very interesting to see the programmatization of these applications. So the idea is early on it required special knowledge. We are seeing spy tools being built and actually commercialized for purposes such as what was just identified. So it's interesting to watch us kind of jump the gap, if you will, from kind of the early adopter or the security folks who understand how this works to making it so anyone can buy a commercial program and actually intercept data or install spyware on a phone. And it's something to be aware of, and I think take caution of. It just underscores the need to protect your devices.
Race, how much were they charging?
You know, I don't recall the price. I just found it interesting. I saw that. I didn't think much of it, and then the story broke, and I thought, why hasn't it been reported that actually it seems to be widespread in Europe and very easy to access to do exactly what these folks have done?
Thanks very much for the call, John Herring. I don't think it's widespread just in Europe.
No, I think it's widespread all around. And in terms of cost, we're seeing it range from $50 to $100 up to about $1,000 for a spy tool like this.
And you could use it for this, allegedly was used to get stories for the newspaper, but you could think of a lot of other reasons why somebody might be interested in hearing somebody else's voicemail messages.
Right. If you installed spyware onto a device, you would essentially be able to intercept any data on the device.
And this is an email from John who repeats what something you just said earlier. Almost all voicemail systems are easy to hack. Most customers leave their password at 1234-1111 or 000. We strongly encourage them to change their password to six or more digits that are not consecutive. Let's see if we get another caller in on the line. And let's go to Charlie. And Charlie's with us from Keokuk in Iowa.
Hi.
Hi, Charlie.
My problem occurred here a couple weeks ago when I got a call on my cell phone, which is registered on the National Do Not Call list. And the incoming number was the same prefix and area code as the local cell phone company issues for the phone service that I subscribe to. And when I picked up the call, it was a solicitation for lower interest rates on my credit card, and which I promptly got off the call, and I asked the caller to remove my phone number from his calling list. And then I called back the number that showed up on my caller ID, which was a local cell number, and ended up being a local gentleman who actually has the number and had no idea that his number was being used by some other company for a solicitation.
His number had been, it also sounds that might have been a phishing call. They may have been trying to, you can get you where your lower interest. If you'll just give us that credit card number and security code over the phone.
That's possible, but I guess I was wondering if there's, you know, what kind of options a person has when those types of calls occur that where I might be able to do something to get them stopped.
John Herring?
So it's generally quite challenging for an individual user to actually trace back someone who might be spoofing another's phone number. You could try calling your mobile operator and inquiring as to if they had seen any activity in relative to numbers that had been calling your account. But beyond that, you know, we're seeing spoofing become more and more common, and it just underscores that we need to be aware of the security threats out there.
John Herring, Charlie, thanks very much for the call, and good luck. I hope that didn't turn into a problem for you. John Herring, thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
John Herring is CEO and founder of Lookout, a mobile security company. He joined us from our bureau in New York. We're talking about the phone hacking scandal that brought down Britain's News of the World. When we come back, Roger Cohen of the New York Times with a defense of Rupert Murdoch. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. And before we leave the subject of phone hacking specifically, I wanted to get to these emails. This from Charles in San Jose. While I have never hacked a phone, I have observed that on airplanes, the first thing my fellow travelers do is check their voicemail when the plane lands. Simply watching the digits they press on the phone reveals their phone number and their password. Since making this observation, I'm very careful when checking my own voicemail. And this from Jason in Newark, Delaware. I've personally hacked into a sibling's fiancé's phone to track her movements and infidelity. I have extensive knowledge on hacking phones legally and through a legal website. Well, the phone hacking scandal continues to widen at News International, the newspaper giant owned by Rupert Murdoch. Even former Prime Minister Gordon Brown made allegations against the company yesterday. At this point, it may be hard to find many to defend the company and its owner, but New York Times columnist Roger Cohen stepped up. He joins us today from our bureau in New York. And Roger Cohen, of course, you start with the caveat that the hacking itself is indefensible.
Yeah, that's right, Neil. Well, partly it's the contrarian in me when everybody's piling in. I want to at least consider if there is a case on the other side. And I feel that with Murdoch there is. The fact is there might not be any press at all in the UK, and there certainly wouldn't be one of the most competitive, open and vigorous free presses and aggressive presses, over-aggressive in the case of the hacking, in the world if it were not for Murdoch. People sometimes portray the UK as if Murdoch runs the show. Well, if you don't want to read a Murdoch paper, you know, read The Guardian, read The Telegraph, read The Mail, read The FT. It's an amazing press scene, and Murdoch has a lot to do with that.
And by press, you're specifically speaking about the newspaper business, not the wider metaphor of the media.
That's right. But even if you look wider than that, Murdoch, of course, against the odds, and when I worked on a long magazine piece about him 20 years ago. He was just embarking on this venture, and everybody was naysaying it. Sky TV, British Sky Broadcasting, the company he's now trying with difficulty to gain all the control of, offers an incredible variety of shows. And it is not Fox. It is Sky has a lot of very good news shows. It's varied. Very strong sports presence, which has always been an area where Murdoch has excelled. So, you know, at least if you look at Britain, and again, you know, the hacking is illegal, it's indefensible, and it's gotten News Corp into a whole pile of trouble. But if you look at the media scene in the UK, it is vigorous and open, and largely thanks to Murdoch.
We want to hear from our callers on this question. On balance, is Rupert Murdoch's contribution a plus or a minus for journalism and for society writ large? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. If you go there, there's a link to Roger Cohen's op-ed in the New York Times in defense of Murdoch. And Roger Cohen, I suspect a lot of people in this country are going to start by saying, hey, what about Fox?
Well, yeah, Neil, what about Fox? I mean, that was my biggest caveat. I don't like Fox at all. And in the column, I described it as shrill right-wing demagoguery, I think, masquerading as news. And I think it's made a very significant contribution to the dearth of reasoned debate and the debunking of reason itself in this country. And the fact that in Washington, and we're seeing it right now with the whole deficit and default debate, it is so incredibly difficult to reach consensus agreement because people go to the shows, sites that comfort what they already believe, and Fox is very prominent in that. So, you know, I don't personally like Fox. Should there be some kind of right-wing network? Yeah, I think they go too far.
And it is interesting. I was in London when Rupert Murdoch bought The Times, perhaps the most famous newspaper in the world. And there were a lot of people who said this is going to be the end, the death of the great newspaper, The Times. A lot of people said the same thing when he bought The Wall Street Journal.
Well, yeah, Neil. I mean, I think The Times is not a bad newspaper. And there are plenty of very serious journalists there doing a pretty good job. Everybody said Murdoch was out of his mind when he took the Times tabloid. And if you'd surveyed 90% of the journalists at the Times then, they would have said it was lunatic. It's been a big success. It's the Telegraph, the broadsheet that looks old-fashioned now, not the Times. And you have correspondents like...
Just to insert here, you're talking about the size of the newspaper,
yeah, the
shape,
size.
Not the style of journalism.
That's right. He took the Times to a tabloid format. The journalism remained pretty serious on the whole. And they've invested in foreign bureaus. Who's doing that? You know, the Chicago Tribune doesn't have a foreign bureau anymore. Washington Post, I don't know what it's down to, but it's a very, very small number. I think my own paper, The New York Times, one of the very few that has remained committed to foreign coverage. Well, The Times in London has done much of the same. And a correspondent like Martin Fletcher, who's been in Libya recently, is one of the best correspondents in the British or American press. So, and you look at The Wall Street Journal, I see some... you know, political intrusion. I used to work at the Journal quite a long time ago. You know, there's some things that make me a little uneasy, but nobody could say the Journal is not still a terrific newspaper. And, you know, he's piled money into the Times in London. He's taken a $2-point-something billion write-off, I think, on Dow Jones. I mean, you could say the guy's nuts. He's got this absolutely visceral love of newspapers, which is where he began. And so he keeps piling money into papers that are not making money. And he's able to do so because he was so brilliant in seeing around the corner where his competitors didn't see in building up TV and entertainment networks. And he was able to do that because he's kept pretty large family ownership of News Corp, which has enabled him, I think, to take risks that he probably wouldn't have been able to take with some other share ownership structure. So he's a pretty... Remember, he started with two little papers in Adelaide. So it is pretty extraordinary what he's done. And it is inevitable that not every... You know, that this causes a lot of envy. I mean, there are very legitimate reasons to criticize Murdoch, very. And we've talked about Fox, and clearly what's been going on in the UK is outrageous. I suspect as this investigation that Prime Minister Cameron has ordered goes forward, we will see it was not confined to News Corp. So there's plenty to criticize, but there is a lot more to the story.
Let's see if we can get some callers in on the conversation. We're Our guest is Roger Cohen, a columnist for The New York Times. His most recent piece is In Defense of Murdoch, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. John is on the line calling from Washington.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to know if you or your guest had any idea about the number of people who are employed by Murdoch-owned companies and the number of shareholders, because it seems to me like, from what I've read, there are about 200 people working at the shutdown paper, which is a fairly considerable number of people. But I'm hesitant about having, while that's a lot of people for one company, you're talking about a huge amount of influence both on the media market but also on politics and culture. And it seems that with great power comes great responsibility, and perhaps there's a need for transparency about who are the shareholders involved.
Well, News Corp is a public company, and that information is available. I don't have it immediately to hand, and certainly it employs tens of thousands, I would say, of people, across the world, and it has annual revenues of about $33 billion and assets, of over $60 billion. And again, this was started almost from nothing. Yes, great responsibility accrues to people like Murdoch, and clearly, in the case of the hacking scandal in the UK, he has not lived up to them, and he's paying a heavy price because, having worked for a year to secure permission to buy all of British Sky Broadcasting, which is very important for the future of News Corp, he now has to demonstrate to authorities that the management of News Corp is reputable. If it is not shown to be reputable, and he may well have to sacrifice his beloved head of News International, Rebecca Brooks, for this to happen, then the deal will not go through. So that would be a very heavy blow to Murdoch. But remember, it's not, the British newspaper scene, at least, media scene, is pretty wild. I mean, if you look at other magnates of the past couple of decades, look at Robert Maxwell, he plundered the pension funds of his newspapers in the UK. Look at Conrad Black. Didn't end well either. You have porn kings owning other newspapers. I mean, I think if you compare Murdoch with some of his peers, he doesn't come out too badly in terms of the public trust.
At least Mr. Maxwell had the grace to die in a mysterious fashion, setting up insane numbers of stories about what may have happened to him for months and years afterwards. But in any case, John, thanks very much for the phone call. Let's see if we go next to this is Michael, and Michael on the line from Seminole in Florida.
Thank you for taking my call. Quick question. If Rupert Murdoch isn't a U.S. citizen and it's found that his corporation, specifically Fox News, has been trying to influence political elections to favor his candidate, could he be found guilty of some laws in that sense?
Rupert Murdoch, first of all, is an American citizen. He has dual American and Australian citizenship.
Yeah, he became a U.S. citizen in 1985. One of the things he doesn't like about the U.K. is this clubbiness of the establishment. And I think one of the things I like about him is he's really attacked that over the years and tried to foster a more open Britain. Now you'll say the latest scandal runs against that. So, it's a mixed picture. To your question, if Fox News, which it clearly does, influences people to think a certain way, there is nothing criminal about that. So I think the answer to your question is no, unless you're talking about the kinds of illicit or illegal methods that we've seen in the UK are being used by his British newspapers. But there's no evidence that any of that has been going on in the United States, as yet, at least.
I think Michael's left us, but thank him very much for his phone call. As you say, Murdoch came in as really an ultimate outsider, the sneered at Aussie from Adelaide, but he is now the ultimate insider.
Well, he's the ultimate insider in some important ways, in that clearly he's played an important role politically in the UK. again, there's a line that Murdoch determined the 97 election that brought in New Labour and Tony Blair, and again he determined the 2010 election that brought in David Cameron and the Conservatives, the Tories, after 13 years in the wilderness. I'm not so sure about that. I think it's more that, again, Murdoch is a very canny guy. He's got his finger to the wind. He's a careful listener. I found in the time I spent with him that he's not one of these, you know, powerful people who whose ego is so large he doesn't listen. I've seen him in interviews. I've seen him talk, and he listens very carefully. Clearly, in 96, he saw what was happening. It was over for the Tories, and clearly it was over for New Labour with Gordon Brown. You certainly didn't have to have particularly astute political antenna to know that.
And probably didn't even have to read his, listen to his voicemail.
That's right. Yeah. And I think Murdoch went with that. And, you know, clearly, given his influence, politicians have been very eager to be on the right side of him. I think we're seeing some change in that now, clearly.
We're talking with Roger Cohen, who wrote most recently In Defense of Murdoch on the op-ed page of the New York Times. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to Charlotte. Charlotte's with us from Tallahassee.
Hello. I was listening to the interview on the radio. I have not read the opinion piece, but I do read the Times sometimes online, and I get the Journal every day and read that. I was worried that the Wall Street Journal would change when Murdoch bought it, but I haven't found that to be the case. My primary comment was that I don't know of a source besides Fox News that will even present the conservative viewpoint. The talk about shrill, I admit it does happen on that television station, but also I know that MSNBC certainly gets shrill, and the mainstream media, in my opinion, only offers a liberal slant, not just in what they do present, but in valid criticisms of current current administration and party in power that are not even mentioned, whereas if it had been the previous administration with the conservative bent, it would have been hammered upon in the mainstream media. So I watch NPR News, I watch network news, and I also turn on Fox News because I want to know everything that's going on. And I really do feel like the mainstream media is anti-conservative, and you feel that by the stories that are in and the stories that are left out.
Charlotte, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. And Roger Cohen, you did mention, while you are not in favor of Fox, that you do see a place for a conservative cable television outlet. But I wanted to get to this email we got from Dan. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the vast number of comments that followed the publication of your article in the New York Times, but a good 90% of those who commented definitely disagree with your evaluation of Mr. Murdoch. Can they all be wrong?
Well, and not only that, I've been inundated with personal email, which is running about 9-1 against, with, you know, one or two very conspicuous exceptions. But yeah, you know, it was a column that went against the grain. I don't expect everyone or even most people to agree with me. I think it made some points that needed to be made, and I think Charlotte, down in, was it North Carolina?
Tallahassee.
Yeah, sorry. Just made some excellent points. You know, one thing, again, I like about Murdoch is he himself is a contrarian. There's nothing he likes more than a scrap. He took a big gamble on Fox. And, you know, he saw this space and he went for it. And he...
if he loves a scrap, he's in one now.
Absolutely. And, you know, similarly with the Journal. You know, I think... Personally, I think he'd love to own the New York Times, but as he can't do that, you know, he bought the Journal, and, you know, lo and behold, he introduced the New York section, beefed up sports. You know, he's fighting the Times, and that's probably good for the Times and good for the Journal. And in the UK, it's been the same story. I mean, the Times has gone after the readership of the Guardian and the Telegraph, and, you know, all that is good. And I think... You know, I think Fox is mainstream media now. So, you know, Charlotte said that the mainstream media is overwhelmingly liberal. You know, the Journal is not. Fox is not. You know, what I don't like is Fox's fair and balanced slogan, which I don't think is lived up to in its style of news gathering and reporting.
Roger Cohen, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Roger Cohen, a columnist for the New York Times. You can find a link to his latest in defense of Rupert Murdoch at npr.org. He joined us from our bureau in New York. Coming up, the president changes policy and decides he will send letters of condolence to the families of service members who take their lives in combat zones. Susanna Breslin says that's not good enough. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.